Here are the nominations for those papers. And I've really had just plain terrific collaborators. And I think I better put on my glasses. Okay, so I'll have a long introduction in order to avoid many details later. So what we've done is to study endpoint on-shell tree amplitudes in n equal 4 Yang Mills, n equal 8 supergravity. And in gauge theory, we'll denote these amplitudes by A sub n and gravity by M sub n. They're endpoint processes. And what I really mean is we study all processes, processes which involve all the states of a given theory. So in Yang Mills, you can have amplitudes built up involving gluons, gluinos, and scalars, and the analog in supergravity. It's well known that those amplitudes can be classified within n to the k MHV sectors. The sector k in supergravity would denote the set of amplitudes which involve k negative velocity gluons. The rest are positive velocity gluons. And you include all the amplitudes which are related to the all gluon amplitudes by Susie Ward identities. And there's an obvious analog to this statement involving in supergravity. It's also well known that the simplest amplitudes are those in the MHV sector, two negative velocity lines, the rest positive, and for the top gluon amplitude, for example. And things become more complex with increasing degrees of away from MHV in gauge theory, and with both increasing particle number and k in supergravity. Now, our focus was generating functions. A generating function is an object which is quite simple and which packages all the endpoint functions in each n to the k MHV sector. And here's a generic notation for that generating function. It depends on the n momenta of the particles which are involved. And as I will say later, we use the spinner helicity formalism in which those momentum are described by a pair of two-component spinners. And the bookkeeping variables in the generating function are Grassmann variables, number of particles times the number of supersymmetries in total number. And the virtue of the generating functions is they encode the state dependence of all of the all of the n to the k, all the amplitudes within a given sector. And I will show that any amplitude can be projected out from the generating function by applying a suitably chosen Grassmann derivative. And to get n to the k processes in n equal 4 theory, you need a derivative of Grassmann order 4k plus 8. And that gets multiplied by, then that gets promoted in supergravity to a higher order derivative. Now, I claim that these generating functions answer quite interesting questions. For example, you get a quite precise characterization of the various sectors. And some of the initial statements that about this may be a little bit surprising, at least they were to me. At the time we started, maybe last February and March in this subject. For example, the MHV, the top amplitude in the MHV sector of n equal 4 theory is the amplitude with two negative velocity gluons and four and many more arbitrary number of positive velocity gluons. But that sector also contains the endpoint function of 8 positive velocity gluinos. Maybe an initial surprise. These operators F sub A and the other operators I'll introduce for particle states later on are annihilation operators. We use that because we have a convention that all the lines are outgoing lines from any amplitude. And we think of the S matrix as built up from a string of annihilation operators acting to the left on the out vacuum state. And generating function also counts the number of this distinct processes in every sector. And that number is a number theory partition function. For example, in n equal to 4 theory, you are interested, if it's the n to the k MHV sector you're interested in, You're interested in the number of partitions of 4k plus 8 with maximum sum and 4. And we'll soon see the reason why it's maximum sum for both of those statements. And here's a small table of some of those numbers. So for example, in the NMHV sector of this gauge theory, there are 34 distinct processes and many, many more in supergravity. By a process, I mean a selection of a specific number of, say, positive velocity gluons, positive velocity gluinos, et cetera. There are many more amplitudes that you can get by rearranging those particles in different orders. So the generating function really does capture an enormous amount of information and it packages it in a rather simple way. So here's a kind of a tabulation of some of the results. I won't be discussing all of them in detail. We're not the first to introduce generating functions. A rather very nice paper by Nair did it for the MHV level in the gauge theory a few years ago. Giorgio Glover and Koza generalized that to NMHV in our first paper and in our August paper. We developed the subject further. I'll talk about what those developments are. And we made some applications, which I'll talk about in a minute or so. And more recently, we turned our attention to actually proving the validity of the recursion relations which underlie these generating functions. And I'll also be talking about that. That was all for gauge theory, the supergravity. In our May paper, we generalized the MHV generating function, and we applied it, as I will say. We also formally extended the generating function to the next MHV level. We found that it works for many 6-point amplitudes, but not all. We also found the situation gets worse as the number of external particles increases. And it finally begins to fail even for pure graviton amplitudes if you have more than 12 external gravitons. It's possible to repair this situation. I will indicate how. But the repair makes the generating function, at least at this level and beyond, somewhat impractical in the applications we have in view. Now, in all of this work, we're motivated by the conjectured ultraviolet finiteness of n equal 8 supergravity. And there's been a long multi-year program by the Baron-Dixon-Kossover group. Along the way, they've had many very good collaborators. As I think most of you know, they published a calculation of the 4 graviton amplitude at the three-loop level, which was found to be ultraviolet finite. Here are two of the very, very many Feynman diagrams which contribute to that amplitude. And they have, in conference talks recently, they have stated that their four-loop computation is very well underway. Now, this probably has raised two questions in your mind, at least two. How can work at the tree level possibly help with a problem which is already, with a program which is already well into the four-loop level? And in view of the fact that we've had limited success with supergravity, how can work in Yang-Mills be relevant to n equal 8 supergravity? And I will try to answer those questions. To answer question one, it's very well known that a direct calculation of Feynman diagrams as they contribute in n equal 8 supergravity is an extremely poor approach. There are far too many diagrams, and they're built with very complicated vertices and propagators. Instead, they obtain the tree amplitudes, the values of the contributing Feynman graphs by a very indirect process. They start with tree amplitudes obtained from recursion relations, and then using unitarity cuts, or generalized unitarity cuts, they build the full amplitudes loop amplitudes from those trees. And to do that, you must sum over all of the intermediate states of the supermultiplet, which can propagate along cut lines. And it is these unitarity sums which are easily done by generating functions. And that's the application which I have in mind. Now, in our first paper in May, we computed a couple of one-loop helicity sums involving MHV amplitudes. I will be talking in detail later about how this computation goes. And it's similar, but only slightly more complicated for the others. In August, we did much more sophisticated sums. We tried to jump ahead to the game. We worked up to for loop order. And we considered here are the diagrams corresponding to our most sophisticated computations. This gray blob indicates a tree amplitude. Here, there are five light lines cut. And you communicate to another tree amplitude. So there's a 7-point times 7-point contribution. And here we have products involving products of three trees with six lines. You can count four loops in each case. These computations are done in gauge theory. So you can have any pattern of gluons, gluinos, and scalars exchanged along these lines. And it is this computation, this sum over various helicity states, which we can do in a very compact fashion. Okay. Well, it's still not clear why trees in the n equal 4 gauge theory can be relevant to calculations in n equal 8 supergravity. And it's been known to answer that. I'll say that it's been known for a long time and made very specific in our May paper that there's a one-to-one map between the 256 states of the supergravity theory and the 16 times 16 states in a direct product of two copies of the spectrum of the n equal 4 theory. So in particular, any supergravity state can be indexed by a pair of integers. And that pair can be put into one-to-one correspondence with a formal direct product of states in the Yang-Mills theory. Now, that's a rather formal statement, although it's perfectly correct and, by the way, compatible with supersymmetry. But we get some dynamical content out of that by using the KLT relations. KLT relations are valid for tree amplitudes. And they don't care. They get more and more complicated as n increases, the number of external particles. But they are indifferent to the type of particles that occur, whether they're gluons, gluinos, or scalars, et cetera, or gravitons, gravitinos on the left side. And the degree of NMHV into the KMHV doesn't change the nature of these relations. So for the 4-point amplitude, it's a simple product of two gauge theory amplitudes. Notice that the momentum labels are permuted. You multiply it by a Mandelstam invariant. If you work your way up to endpoint functions, well, I've been more schematic here, you get a kinematic factor, which depends on pairwise Mandelstam invariants in the various channels. That's a channel label ij, vi, vj. And you multiply, you sum over a large number of permutations, and the permutations in the two gauge theory factors are related in a well-defined but somewhat complicated way. So that's the schematic indication of the KLT relation. But this is enough to allow you to express any helicity sum in the supergravity theory as a product of helicity sums in two factors of the gauge theory. So that is why extensive work on gauge theory trees and generating and computation of helicity sums is relevant. So I would hope people have had some exposure to the spinner helicity formalism, but let me try to summarize very briefly. If you went to a very good high school, well, to a reasonably good high school, you would learn that any four momentum can be spinnerized. Spinnerized means it can be represented as a product of as a bispinner with a two by two dotted and undotted indices. And in case you forget your high school education, that is the explicit construction is done by contracting the four momentum with these 2x2 vial matrices. If your high school was a very good one, you would have learned that if you're talking about a null vector, which is a physical momentum for a massless particle, then that bispinner is rank one, and it can be expressed as a simple product of spinners. Okay. It's universal in this game to use a better or more symbolic notation. And in our conventions, it's the dotted index spinner, which is replaced by an angle bracket, and the undotted one by a square bracket spinner. So an angle bracket hides the two-component spinner. The bracket hides the two-component spinner index. Okay, there are Lorentz invariant inner products formed with the invariant epsilon tensor. And, well, I think that's pretty obvious. All right, there are other things you have to do to play this game, but let me not go into detail on all of them. There's a very nice textbook which features spinner helicity methods written by Shrednicki, appeared about a year and a half ago. And if you look in the basics of this, this formalism, it turns out that these two-component spinners, no matter how you denote them, are left and right-handed solutions of the Dirac equation. And if you work at the level of the textbooks, then the two spinners are related by complex conjugation. But if you're to work, if you graduate from high school or from graduate school, and you're interested in modern applications, it's very important to consider complex null momenta. A complex null momentum is defined by a rank one product in these spinners. We can write it in dyadic form involving this more abstract notation. And it's important that the spinners need not be related by complex conjugation. They're independent until you go to evaluate a very physical amplitude. The poster boy for the success of this program is the simple form of the Park-Taylor MHV amplitudes for endpoint functions involving gluons. Since tree amplitudes don't know about the rest, tree amplitude involving gluons, no matter how many, doesn't know about the presence of the rest of the helicity states in the n equal 4 theory, this expression is equally valid in just plain Yang-Mills and in n equal 4. So it involves a numerator weighting function for the two helicities you've chosen to be negative helicity, and then you get a cyclic product of angle bracket spinners as you go around these set of states that parameterize the amplitude. Perhaps I should have had a figure here. Sorry that I didn't. Okay, so what else should be said? Yeah, I'm sorry. These are planar amplitudes in the gauge theory. Color order, that is, and that's why we deal with things which only have cyclic symmetry. So the Park-Taylor amplitudes are simple. Okay, they're purely holomorphic. In my language, that means it depends on the angle spinners and not on the square spinners for the various states. And this remarkably simple expression agrees with the sum of many, many Feynman diagrams. For example, the 8 gluon tree amplitude expressed as a very simple way up here, has 200 or so contributing Feynman diagrams. Okay, so now let's describe the n equal 4 theory in more detail. When we first ran in our first approach to this subject, I think in our May paper, we always talked about annihilation operators for the reasons that I said. The positive helicity gluon operator is denoted by B plus. Positive gluino by F for fermion, obviously. It carries one SU4 index. The scalars involve an satisfy an SU4 self-duality condition. And then you have the negative helicity minus a half and minus two particles. It's much, you get a lot more information more quickly if you use the Levi-Civita tensor for SU4 to raise all the indices. And you replace the operators in this list by what appears directly below them in the list below. So in this designation, every particle transforms in an anti-symmetric tensor representation of the tensor product of the fundamental representations of SU4. And you can simply read the helicity and the Bose statistics just from reading the pattern of SU4 indices attached to these annihilation operators. From the field theory, you have two sets of supercharges, the dotted and undotted spinner index charges. It's useful to keep the SU4 indices explicit. It appears as an anti-fundamental in the Q tilde and as a fundamental index in the Q because they're formally related by adjoints in the field theory. I've indicated here in a somewhat schematic way, well, no, this is a quite precise way, but it's incomplete since I didn't want to swamp the audience with lots of details of how these supercharges act on the annihilators. And they act according to the pattern which I've tried to put into words here. The tilde Q supercharge raises the helicity of any state by a half a unit. It clearly eliminates an SU4 index, and it involves the angle scalar product between the Suzy spinner, which would appear here, and the spinner associated with the momentum of the particle state. And the Q upper A supercharge acts analogously. So here, for example, since the positive helicity gluon is the highest helicity amplitude in supergravity, when you apply Q tilde charge to that, it tries to raise it. It doesn't have any state to raise to, and you get zero. But the positive helicity gluon can be raised into a positive helicity gluino can be raised into a positive helicity gluon. Now, putting aside things that begin to be sophisticated, you can get an awful lot of information just by looking at the specific pattern of SU4 indices on any amplitude. And if you think of it, if you do this bookkeeping in terms of upper indices, then you have to think of amplitudes, well, amplitudes become SU4 invariant, provided they can saturate the indices on a product of Levi-Civita tensors. And obviously, if you have, well, okay. And if you think of that, what that means, the states of any non-vanishing amplitude have to carry a total number of indices, which is a multiple of 4. If you write it as 4k plus 1, 4k plus 4 in the gauge theory, then the index k corresponds to the degree of next to MHV. Okay? And to get something non-vanishing, each index value from 1 to 4 has to appear the same number of times, namely k plus 2 times. So here are some examples of what that consideration immediately leads to. So here's an amplitude which has a total of 8 indices. It's a scalar, a negative helicity gluino, positive helicity gluons, positive helicity gluon, gluino, and another scalar. 8 indices total. Each index appears twice, and that's an MHV amplitude, which is non-vanishing. Here's one with 12 indices. It's NMHV. It's the basic NMHV amplitude with 3 negative helicity gluons, and particles 2, 4, and 5 are positive helicity gluons. Here's an amplitude which vanishes. Can't must vanish by SU4 invariance because it contains a total of 10 indices. You can't saturate those indices on any product of epsilon tensors. And even going ahead further, where you try to write down very concrete, exact representations for these amplitudes, it always pays to go back to this very plebeian but useful way to look at things. OK, generating functions. That's what we concentrate on. The generating function written down by Nair for the MHV level in N equal 4 theory is a very interesting object. It contains an 8-dimensional delta function, which I'll specify, talk about in a few minutes. It contains in the denominator the cyclic factor, which governs all of the Park-Taylor amplitudes. It may not be totally obvious, but it is true that the generating function is Lorentz invariant, SU4 invariant, and it's cyclically symmetric. Now, if you went to a really good high school, you would have been taught about Grassmann value delta functions. And if you have a delta function of m Grassmann variables, you would have learned that it's simply the product of those variables. And what we have here is a very slight generalization of that. We have a delta function with 8 arguments. There's an SU4 index argument and a Lorentz argument, which is a dotted spinner. And if you just write down this general, if you just extend that high school product algorithm to this case, this somewhat formal looking delta 8 that appears up there can just be written as a product from A equal 1 to 4 and a sum over the various contributing angle spinners for the momenta of the particles that are involved, and then products of the Grassmann bookkeepers. So you see this delta 8 contains product. It's a sum of products of 4 times 2 or 8 Grassmann variables. And therefore, you can project out a C number by applying an eighth order Grassmann derivative. And that Grassmann derivative just gives you a product of 4 scalar products, 4 of these Lorentz invariant scalar products involving these angle brackets. Now, what we did in our May paper was to show that there's a one-to-one association between particles of the spectrum of the theory and Grassmann, particular Grassmann differential operators. The top helicity state, a positive gluon, is just associated with the multiplication by 1, no operator whatsoever. A positive helicity gluino is a first order derivative involving the Grassmann bookkeepers. A scalar, which is rank 2 in the SO4 description, is a second order differential operator, and so on. Very specific correspondence between the particles of the theory and differential operators. Now, I claim, and I'll try to show by example, how any amplitude that you're interested in can be obtained by applying the corresponding, and there's a one-to-one correspondence, the corresponding eighth order derivative to the generating function. So suppose you're interested in the very basic Park-Taylor amplitudes, 2 negative helicity gluons, and the rest positive helicity. Well, you have to apply the fourth order Grassmann differential operator, which corresponds to a negative helicity gluon with momentum P1, another one for momentum P2 to that delta 8. And it's very easy to see that the derivative just gives you the product, the scalar, the angle bracket between spinners 1 and 2, which restores that factor which I previously had in the Park-Taylor amplitudes. If you're interested in a more complicated process involving a negative gluon, 2 positive gluinos, and a scalar, well, you just write down the corresponding string of operators. You apply that to the delta function, although I'll give a simpler method in a moment, and you get a particular product of a total of 1, 2, 3, 4 of these angle brackets. So this particular product, and it's always a product of 4 angle brackets because it's an eighth order differential operator, we call the spin factor of an amplitude. And although you can apply, well, there's a much simpler way than digging into that representation of delta 8, which I had in the previous transparency, you can show that that calculation is completely equivalent to calculating using your Wick contraction rule. So if you're interested in Wick contraction of 2 operators corresponding to particle I and particle J, there's a certain number of Grassmann derivatives in between, depending on which ones you choose. That determines a sign according to fermion Grassmann anti-commutativity, and you just get a Kronecker delta in the SU4 indices times the corresponding spinner product. So it's very easy to do things that way. It's a little bit hard to keep track of signs, but if you keep track of exchanges, that can be done too. And these spin factors are very smart. For example, if an amplitude is required to vanishes by SU4 symmetry, the spin factor will automatically vanish and tell you that. Now, I talked about the supercharges in the quantum field theory. They have exact analogs which operate in the space of the spinners and the Grassmann variables of the generating function. And the dotted index supercharge is just multiplicative in the Grassmann variables. The undotted index supercharge is a differential operator, okay, summed over the, all the external states of the process. And without much trouble, you can show, and we showed in our May paper, that you get the correct SUSY anti-commutator. I write it as a commutator because you remember that we included the epsilon supersymmetry spinners in our definition. Now, you might say, well, I learned in high school supersymmetric quantum field theory that you're supposed to obtain p slash on the right-hand side. How can it be correct if you obtain zero? Well, it is correct because in this formalism, you're always applying the differential, the supercharges to on-shell amplitudes, and the total momentum is equal to zero in an on-shell amplitude. So that's why you get zero on the right-hand side. You can show that this correspondence between differential operators that I mentioned and the particle states is compatible with supersymmetry because the commutators of the supercharge, the supercharge Q tilde with those operators is exactly isomorphic to the field, the way the field theory supercharge acts on the particle annihilators. You can also show that you get the correct Ward identities, both formal and concrete Ward identities. By formal Ward identity, I mean you just operate on the generating function with a supercharge and you get zero. And it's easy to see why you get zero, because the argument of the supercharge is just one of the eight components which has been set equal to zero by that delta eight in the generating function. A concrete Ward identity obtains in the following way. You apply that Q tilde supercharge to a product of nine derivatives applied to the generating function, and then you move Q tilde to the right. As you move it to the right, you pick up commutators between the multiplicative eta that appears in Q and the differential operators that appear here, and you can show that this relation that you that well, then you finally get to the end and you find that Q tilde annihilates the supercharge, and you get a sum of terms, and that sum of terms can be shown to be exactly the same relation among amplitudes which you would get in a field theory approach to the same Ward identity. And the situation for the other supercharge is very, very similar. Now, in our May paper, we extend, it was not too difficult to extend this generating function to the MHV sector of n equal 8 supergravity. And as a prefactor, rather than that cyclic prefactor in n equal 4 theory, what you have is the n graviton MHV amplitude divided by the normalization factor, which singles out the two negative, well, not normalization, divided by the scalar product factor, which singles out which two gravitons carry the negative velocity. Now, you might expect that this quantity has only a reduced Bose symmetry under the exchange of any two positive velocity gravitons and any two negative velocity, but it turns out to have a hidden full Bose symmetry under any exchange among the labels of the n particles. And this becomes the prefactor in the generating function. And given that prefactor, which is a lot more complicated, by the way, than the Park-Taylor amplitude, nevertheless, you can easily write the generating function. Okay? It's a it's the product of the prefactor times now a 16 component delta function of exactly the same structure, except now we have a label for SU8 representations, A going from 1 to 8. So it's a 16-dimensional delta function. And this W depends both on angle and square spinners, and I've indicated that here. So you now have twice as many Grassmann variables. Okay. Nevertheless, that you can extend the previous program in a very straightforward way. You can define a one-to-one association between the particles of the supergravity theory and Grassmann differential operators, here extending from rank 0 all the way up to rank 8. And you can show that, So what we have here is a product, the delta function, if you use that product representation, is a sum of products of 16 Grassmann Eta's, and you project out any amplitude you wish by applying the associated 16th order Grassmann derivative. Okay. And it turns out that there's a one-to-one correspondence between MHV processes in supergravity and partitions of the number 16 with maximum summand 8. Maximum summand is 8 because the highest operator you're allowed to apply is of eighth order. And it's easy to count these partitions, and they're, as I said, as I indicated in one of my earlier slides, 186 different MHV processes in supergravity. Okay, so here's the meat of our applications, and I want to go into some detail here. Suppose you want to calculate the one loop cut contribution to a process involving arbitrary numbers of n equal 4. And this, by the way, here we can do it equally easily in supergravity and in n equal 4, but I'll speak the language of n equal 4. Okay. So to do this, we simply write down the product of the two generating functions for the left-hand amplitude, which is many to two, and the right-hand amplitude, which is two to many. Okay. And I will illustrate how we start from this product and calculate the contribution of the cut amplitude. Sorry? In the center? I didn't hear your last two words. Yes, we are. Well, I'm sorry. At one loop order, there's no difference. All the graphs are the same, right? Planar or non. You can untwist the non-planar amplitude. At higher loop, we have to be more careful. Higher loop contributions have to be more careful about ordering the states. And in fact, we have only done explicitly planar ones. Okay, so here's the product of generating functions. These are the cyclic prefactors already from the Park-Taylor amplitudes. Here are the bookkeeping delta eights. And we use a common eta variable to describe the states on both sides of the each internal line. And we apply fourth order Grassmann derivatives in the momentum, of course, of the loop momentum L1 and the loop momentum L2. And it is then you see if you move those derivatives forward and act on the product just using the Leibniz generalized Leibniz rule, taking into account the commutativity, what we say is that automatically takes care of the sum over states. It automatically sums the states for you. And here's how it works. So we use a common Grassmann variable for both of this, for the internal states on either side of an internal line, you can apply at most four derivatives with respect to those Grassmann variables on each factor. So there's one term in which the fourth order derivative with respect to loop momentum one appears applied to the first delta function for the amplitude I, and then you're forced to apply the remaining four derivatives to the right-hand factor. That corresponds exactly to the gluon loop contribution to the loop. So for example, this fourth order derivative tells you that it is a negative velocity gluon, which is emitted from left-hand amplitude. Of course, it goes over here and is absorbed in the final amplitude, the amplitude called J over there. But in our bookkeeping, that's viewed as an outgoing positive velocity gluon. And then complementary things that are forced to appear down here. There are other terms in the generalized Leibniz evaluation of this product in which you have three derivatives with respect to loop momentum one, and then a fourth derivative with respect to loop momentum two. And then you're forced to apply the missing derivatives to the other Grassmann factor. And you can argue that this corresponds, you can easily see that this corresponds to a gluino loop in which you would emit a negative velocity gluino at this point, It's matched by the emission of the Bruena with a complementary SU4 index here. That's necessary to get respect SU4 symmetry. And again, we want Bruena's down here. My notation isn't perfect here, but there are four ways to choose the indices here. So this back Bruena contribution comes in weighted by 4. And if you're careful about anti-commuting the derivatives, you get exactly the high school minus sign for fermion Lewin. And if you continue to include all the rest of the Leibnizian terms, you get the contribution of 6 scalars, 4 Bruenos of the opposite helicity, and the gluons. So this is one way to carry out the helicity sum, but it's extremely awkward if you'd have to do it this way every time. Here it's just a binomial series. You could do it, but in the more complicated cases, it's considerably messier than that. So in practice, we can do it extremely simply. We can simply directly apply the product of differential operators to the product of the Grassmann bookkeepers. And I need a little bit more detail about for that. I need to tell you that the delta 8 for the left-hand factor contains a sum over however many external lines there are. And then there are spinners and Grassmann variables for the internal states, okay? Number 1 and number 2. The signs are not so important here, but in more complicated computations, you do have to keep track of these signs. It tells you ingoing versus outgoing. The bookkeeper for delta function J is very similar. Okay. Then you use, again, a delta function identity, which you certainly learned in junior high school for ordinary delta functions. But for Grassmann delta functions, it also works. Delta of argument I, delta of argument J, it's the same as a delta function for the sum of the arguments times the delta function for any one of the factors. If you look up here in the sum of the arguments, the internal state disappears completely, and therefore I plus J depends only on the external variables. If it depends only on the external variables, you can just move the Grassmann derivatives right through it. Those Grassmann derivatives then simply get applied to the bookkeeper, which contains those internal variables. And I'm sorry, I should have said something here. That delta 8 is very complicated. It, in principle, contains the sum over all the contributing scalar products of pairs of particles in that final amplitude up here. But you're only interested in picking up picking up 8 derivatives with respect to the loop variables. So only this factor, 1 out of many, is relevant. And you automatically get the right weighting factor for the contribution, for this total contribution to the spin helicity sum. So if you put back the cyclic Park-Taylor factors, you get a generating function for the cut one loop diagram. And then you can apply the correct differential operators for external lines, and you obtain the contribution of the cut amplitude to any process that you might want. So that's really very, very simple. Okay. Let's go to higher order, NMHV and beyond. Okay. Now, there are a couple of approaches now which are used in this game. And we took a very conservative approach. We want to use the MHV vertex expansion, which was obtained by Cachazzo, Sverchek, and Witten before modern recursion relations were developed by the same set of authors and other authors. And in that construction, you express an n to the k MHV amplitude in terms of elements which are much simpler MHV subamplitudes. And that has a number of advantages, at least as I see it. First of all, the expansion comes out in terms of diagrams. And physicists are used to thinking in terms of diagrams. There are far fewer MHV vertex diagrams than Feynman diagrams. This is of polynomial order. This is of exponential order. The MHV vertices are very slightly modified Park-Taylor amplitudes, and they're thus extremely simple. And we have shown in much of our work how easy it is to code the results and test things numerically. Now, Cachazzo, Spircheck, and Witten were motivated by twister methods. A full justification of their expansion and its extension in particular to what we're interested in, to all of the N equal 4 gauge theory, requires recursion relations. And I want to talk a little bit about those recursion relations. They are inspired by the beautiful method of BCFW from 2005. But it's based on a different shift. The basic ideas of analyticity and factorization are there, as I will indicate, but we're using a shift of momenta devised by Rissiger, again later in 2005, and talked about and developed further by Bjerenborg, Dunbar, Eta, Perkins, and Rissiger. So at the MHV level, what Rissiger showed is that you need a shift of three external momenta. You can take them to be any three. Let's, for simplicity, choose them to be momentum numbers 1, 2, and 3. And that shift is specified in terms of what it does to the spinners that correspond to the various momenta. Angle spinners don't shift. And the square bracket spinners do shift. The shift is proportional to z times the angle spinner between particles 2 and 3. And it involves a reference spinner x, which is an arbitrary spinner. And then square spinners 2 and 3, the corresponding formulas are just the cyclic permutations. So the shifted momenta are products in this dyadic formalism of an angle spinner times a square spinner. It's still of rank 1, so you're still describing an on-shell vector, continued, of course, in a complex direction, complex momentum. And then you can show that the overall momentum is conserved if you use a Skouten identity, and that's where this particular choice of scalar product comes into the game. Now, when we apply it in the N equal 4 theory, we have to be a little bit more restrictive as to which set of lines we shift, and we have to choose a set of lines in which the three particles carry a common value, either 1, 2, 3, or 4 of the SU4 industries. And there's always at least one such common index shift which you can choose. Now, it's well known, of course, that analytically continued tree amplitudes have very simple analyticity properties. The only singularities are poles. They are poles where the Feynman diagrams for the shifted momenta vanish. And then if you know that the amplitude vanishes as z goes to infinity, and normally it would vanish for all choices of the reference spinner, then you simply take a contour integral. The contour integral encircles all the poles. From the pole at z equals 0, you obtain just the unshifted amplitude, because z has been set equal to 0. The shift disappears. And that's equal to a sum over all the rest of the physical poles coming from the shifted propagators. And when you look in a bit more detail, use factorization, then you find that the amplitude you're interested in is a sum of amplitudes involving a smaller number of external particles weighted effectively by the scalar product carrying the channel momentum of the sum of the external momenta, which are in, say, N1. Now, if you did, you get a similar structure if you use the original two-line BCFW shift. But the problem here is that the sub-amplitudes you get include both MHV cross MHV, which would be quite simple, but they also include anti-MHV times NMHV sub-amplitudes. So if you're interested in the NMHV amplitudes, which is where we're at now, you lose the simplicity of having only MHV amplitudes on this side. So the nice effect of the Rissiger three-line shift is that the only sub-diagrams that occur are MHV, and they're very simple Park-Taylor amplitudes. Now, the contribution of each diagram depends on the reference spinner, but it follows from Cauchy's theorem that the sum over diagrams does not. As you're evaluating at z equals 0, where since z multiplies the reference spinner, its dependence on x simply is not present, provided the asymptotics has been correctly estimated. Okay, so it was Giorgio Glover and Cosa who showed how to extend Nair's, how to package all of this in a generating function for the gauge theory. The generating function for each diagram is the product of generators for each of the MHV factors. So here's a representative diagram. There's a free particle amplitude on the left and a n minus one particle amplitude on the right, if you want to get represent AN. Hope I said that correctly. I may have been off by a bit. And just as it did in the unitarity sum, if you apply a fourth order derivative in the Grassmann variable for the states on either side of the internal line, then you describe properly what's going on, what is exchanged across that internal line. And just as I did in the previous computation, it's not difficult to apply using that high school delta function identity to see what that derivative is applied to these eight-dimensional delta function bookkeepers. And in the final, to get the final generating function, you have to sum over all the diagrams. This delta 8 bookkeeper comes out in front of the sum. You get a sum over diagrams. And you find the cyclic factors associated with the particular subamplitudes. You find the propagator corresponding to 1 over p squared, where p here would be p12, quantity squared. And the effect of the, and then you get basically a sum, what I call sigma prime here. Sigma prime means you sum only over the external particles in the subamplitude. Of their scalar products with the state corresponding to the internal line embedded here, or here. I guess it's over here since we've chosen the left amplitude, times their Grassmann bookkeepers. And that internal state is evaluated by what is now called the CSW prescription. It takes some justification to get to this point, but let me just state the prescription. That state is the momentum applied to the reference spinner, momentum expressed as a example in that two-particle channel. You would express p12 as angle spinner for 1, square spinner for 1, plus angle square. Okay, I think I even have that one right. And that's the expression you would carry through to the final end of your computation. OK, I've repeated here just to have something to look at, that generating function formula at the top of the page. Okay. It's not difficult to count the number of diagrams you get at the NMHV level. Okay. It's of order n squared over 2. And it's certainly much smaller than the number of Feynman diagrams, which are, at least roughly speaking, of order 2 to the n for an n particle an NMHV process. I don't have time to do full injustice to our other approaches. I'll talk more about Drum and Handit when I finish, I hope. They have an alternate approach, which has the virtue that the tree amplitudes are expressed in terms of dual superconformal invariants. We're interested in practical applications, however. They do seem to have a virtue of smaller number of amplitudes, although for large n, it's of the same order as ours. But the expression for each diagram is much more complicated, and we don't think it would be very easy to code that. And coding is very important in all practical applications in this game. Okay. You see that we now have products of eight Grassmann variables here. Four more here, so the generating function at this level is a product of 12 Grassmann eta's. And you can argue and show by many examples that you get the correct NMHV amplitude by applying the correct corresponding 12th order Grassmann operator to this generating function. Now, in practice, we don't really use this somewhat formal expression, although we do use it in a way that I'll say in a moment. In practice, you want to go back to a very concrete representation of the amplitude in which you specify its SU4 indices of external states, and you immediately can, by hand, calculate the spin factors. You can do it by hand, and you can also do it by machine. And we have calculated and tested many amplitudes for X independence, and it's always exactly, always correctly satisfied in the N equal 4 theory. Here's an example. So this is an overall NMHV amplitude. There are a total of 12 indices on the external lines. There are three scalars involved, two negative helicity gluonos, and a positive helicity gluon. Each external index appears once, okay? Appears three times, excuse me. The vertices are unique, well, there's a unique MHV vertex on each side, and just from the SU4 indices on the internal lines, that says that the choice of indices on the internal line is completely uniquely determined. Okay? So there's a rank 3 or a negative helicity gluino exchanged across. In our bookkeeping, that corresponds to a positive helicity gluino being emitted here with the complementary index 1. And everything is now SU4 invariant. And you can immediately write down the spin factors using the Wick contraction algorithm. We do have to be careful about signs, and our computer programs can do that. The more formal expression here is what we use. It does have a concrete use when we evaluate unitarity sums in which NMHV amplitudes contribute. Now, I'm sorry, how many minutes do I have? I don't think I need more than 10 minutes.
10 minutes?
I hope so.
Okay, yeah, because we started
a bit late. Okay. In our paper, which will hopefully soon be out, we concerned ourselves with the extension to general n to the k amplitudes. And we found that, at least for purposes of the proof, an all-line shift was the most efficient to use, an all-line shift in which angle brackets do not shift, square brackets do shift. There's also a reference spinner, and momentum conservation is ensured if you impose conditions on these coefficients C. Although the all-line shift simplifies the argument considerably, we still need a rather intricate inductive argument involving both the number of external particles and the amount of next to MHV, so I'm not going to go into the proof here. Once you get, say, up to level n cubed MHV, you get vertex diagrams of various topologies. So at n cubed level, you get diagrams with 4 MHV nodes connected by internal spinners. They can appear in a chain, or they can appear as kind of a star diagram. And I'm not going to write down the formula for this generating function. It's a rather straightforward generalization of what I did write for the NMHV case. There's an overall delta function. There are those products of 4 Grassmann variables for 3 of the amplitudes. They're the internal propagators, and they're the cyclic factors for Park-Taylor. Now, we've made numerical checks of X independence for several n squared MHV amplitudes, and we're able to make analytic checks up to the n cubed MHV amplitudes because you can choose very carefully by inspection of the external indices, you can choose amplitudes which only have a very small number of contributing diagrams, and then you can work analytically. What was a surprise, at least to us, is that you can show that as you increase the degree of away from MHV and you study the large Z dependence, you get a faster fall off 1 over Z to the K. That's true for both the all line shift, and it's true for any K plus 2 line common index shift. And you can show that K plus 2 lines is the minimum shift in an N to the K amplitude, which for which the contributing amplitudes are only MHV. and you do reproduce the CSW expansion. And in this case, by the way, many amplitudes even go faster than this 1 over z to the k amplitude. That's a statement about the behavior of each diagram. There can be further cancellations among diagrams. Let me talk about the gravity case. We tried in our May paper to extend construction to the NMHV level in supergravity. Formally, it's easy to do that. You just get 16, you just get more bookkeepers, and you have these more complicated weight factors, which are permutation symmetric, which I discussed. The generating function is a sum of products of 16 plus 8, or 24 bookkeepers. And you might at least hope that you can project out the correct amplitudes by applying the associated 24th order operator. Well, we did this. We checked the dependence, independence on x of many amplitudes, and we compared with the KLT formula. And by the way, it's these extra Mandelstam, and well, okay, I'm sorry. Maybe I should make that point in next transparency. So we found success with many six-point amplitudes at the NMHV level at supergravity. Results were x-independent. But unfortunately, for a reasonably large number, always involving lower spin particles, for example, with six scalar amplitudes, we found the results depended on x. And we wondered why. And we went back to the KLT formula. And you can take the KLT formula, which doesn't involve shifted momenta. And you can nevertheless carry out that momentum shift, evaluate the KLT formula for complex shifted momentum, and you find that the bad cases, which depended on x, either are constant as z goes to infinity or they grow linearly as z goes to infinity. So one would say that there's a pole at infinity, at least for generic values that reference spinner x. It turns out that numerically you can examine the leading power of z, that shifted KLT amplitude. In many cases, it was a sixth order polynomial in the spinner x. Mathematica can evaluate the roots of that polynomial. At the roots, the correct suppression at large z is satisfied, not for all x, but at least for these special roots of the sixth order polynomial. You go back to the generating function, set x equal to those values, and you find that you match the KLT formula. So the method can be corrected, but it would be very cumbersome in applications to use this, to require this auxiliary KLT evaluation of the amplitude. We then suspected things would go wrong even for the graviton pure graviton amplitude. So again, we looked at KLT, and we found that the rate of growth at large z increases with the number of external particles. So this construction would fail even for gravitons only, beginning at number 12 external gravitons. And it's those factors of the Mandelstam invariance in the KLT formula which give you the positive powers of z, which spoil the asymptotics. Okay. Well, just a couple minutes, but I should talk about competing approaches. Arkani Hamed Kashazo and Kaplan, and later a Queen Mary group, investigated two-line supershifts, constructing generating functions by a shift which combines the BCFW shift on one square bracket and one angle bracket with a shift of the eta variable designed to make the supercharge invariant. And this is a very nice idea. It has many advantages. And we're looking at it. We're seeing if it can be extended to the K-line shifts, which are necessary in our approach, at least, to describe NMHV level and beyond. And it's not clear yet whether it will work. It certainly does not work in a straightforward way. Drummond and Henn were, quite remarkably, able to solve this supershifted recursion relation and get a representation for arbitrarily complex tree amplitudes. And that representation was constructed from involving dual superconformal invariants. Now, I would think that dual conformal invariance is probably a very fundamental concept, but as I perhaps said before, we're interested in practical applications of these formulas. And at least in this present approach of Drummond and Henn, you need more and more complicated superconformal invariants as you increase the level of K. And we're not at all convinced that that approach is going to be productive. Conclusions. So I hope I've told you that, at least in the gauge theory, generating functions based on the MHD vertex expansion can be proven and constructed. They apply to amplitudes of arbitrary complexity. For n equal to 8, we succeed at the MHV level. That's enough to do a reasonably large class of unitarity sums. But I've indicated what the problems are when we go beyond MHV. In the gauge theory, we've made, and at the MHV level in the supergravity, we've made many, many applications to unitarity or sums. I've talked about some of them. Several topics I've had to omit. You would hope, this is open questions, that we could improve somehow the treatment of supergravity, get a more efficient way to construct NMHV amplitudes and beyond. I don't know the answer to that question. We discovered a highly divergent behavior at large Z for when you have enough external gravitons. And I've always wondered, and we do not have an answer, as to whether that is relevant to the ultraviolet finiteness program in n equal to 8. Large Z behavior of a tree amplitude corresponds to a continuation in a certain direction of the loops. And I don't know what the consequences might be. Final transparency speaks for itself. This was fun. Thank you.
Any questions?
Yeah, Freddy?
So how did you see this map that you said between n equals 8 superspace and n equals 4 times n equals 4? How do you see that evolving as you move in the moduli space of n equals 8?
Well, at each point in the I don't think you see it explicitly. At each point in the moduli space, you get another copy of the spectrum, which is identical. And you just map that identical copy. The excitations around that point have an isomorphic description to those around any other point.
So this SU4 plus SU4 will move around?
No, it's fixed. The SU4 plus SU4 is fixed. Moduli space in the end. You don't.
No, what I mean, what I mean is that the mapping would have to change. So there is no.
I see what you mean.
I mean, n equals 4 doesn't have a model. The same massless moduli space as.
I would, well, frankly,
so
no. We have not attempted to follow the mapping, to follow the migration to moduli space in terms of S mapping. We effectively were working at the origin. I'm not clear you can do that. I think if it becomes a bookkeeping device which allows you to generate amplitudes at any point in moduli space, but I don't think you see the effects of the migration of the mapping on the gauge theory side.
Okay.
That's my first impression. Perhaps it should require more thought.
Any questions?
Uh-huh. To make a really basic question. When you write this amplitude as a sum of this much lower number than the Feynman diagram, but the MHV for you, you have, is each individual term in this sum is gauge invariant?
What do you mean by each individual term in the sum involves on-shell states? I don't think you can then discuss them. You cannot discuss the. I think the question of gauge transformation is meaningless.
When you write this as a sum Feynman diagram, contribution of each Feynman diagram is not gauge.
Yeah, because you have an explicit epsilon spinner in the game, and you can translate it by k, and you can see that each individual amplitudes might depend on k. I don't see how to do this on these.
CSW expansion, the diagrams in this expansion. No, I'm sorry, I don't see how to do it. Each diagram is, each MHV, well, I mean, there's a recipe for writing effectively the, in spinorellicity formalism what the polarization vector is for an external gluon, for example. But the final things you deal with only involve angle spinners for physicalicity particles. And I don't see how to make a gauge invariant, a gauge transformation at that point. It is gauge invariant. Everything is on shell. Stated another way, the virtue of the formalism is you construct gauge, you construct amplitudes from completely gauge invariant elements. You agree with that?
Yes. Yeah.
Perhaps that was a shorter answer, which I should have said first.
Any other questions? So let's thank the speaker again.